We've all had fierce and formidable women in our lives who have shaped who we are now. The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is dedicated to celebrating women who have shaped the education landscape more than you can possibly imagine. Who better to host this conversation than Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson, two fierce and formidable women who have been driving innovation in the field of the education world for more than 30 years. Please welcome our hosts, Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson.
Welcome, everyone, to episode number 27 of Tech and Learning's Honor Roll, a podcast that celebrates fierce and formidable women in education. I'm Keisha Ray.
And I'm Frances Gibson. And we're here today to find some joy in our journey. We hope you've got those earbuds in and are out enjoying the sunshine. We're going to take a journey again with another fierce female with an incredibly inspirational story. So joining us is a national higher education icon and now honor roll Shiro. Let's learn a little bit more about Dr. Sue Borrego. Dr. Borrego is a student-centered leader. Keisha, you and I love student-centered leaders, so she is on the right show. She has a commitment to academic innovation and a passion for community transformation. Her career is driven by a dedication to student success, inspired by her ability to see the difference higher education can make. Should we all have this opportunity, she knows that we can get to this space together. She makes a difference in the lives of our students. And while serving as chancellor, Dr. Borrego quickly established herself as an engaged community partner and energetic promoter of the UM Flint as an anchor regional comprehensive university dedicated to research, innovation, and investments that advance the campus and community. In fact, Keisha, under her leadership, the university footprint grew by over 25%, and I'm sure it grows exponentially as a result of her continued legacy. Additionally, there were increases in retention and graduation rates at her university, and during the water crisis, which we all read about, this Flint chancellor provided critical leadership for the campus and community. You know, she's a nationally renowned leader and a fierce advocate for student success, particularly for the traditionally underrepresented students, and she's been on numerous boards and national task forces. I think we'll be signing her up for even more as a result. She's a recognized expert across the landscape, especially in the space of inclusion, as it relates to student success, and she's presented and published over 50 times on the topic just in the past two decades. I'm hoping that a lot of our guests will take a look at her TED Talks as a result of listening to her inspirational story. You know, she lives still in the Flint area with her amazing partner, Mary, and they are the proud parents of two children and nine grandchildren. Then in her spare time, I can't believe she has any, she's an avid reader who also enjoys paddleboarding. You got to try that out with us. And loves being on the lake, of course, and watching collegiate sports.
Let me tell you, when everybody comes together for our hopefully in-person group of Shiros, we're going to have so much fun with Sue.
Yes, we will.
Sue, I'm so glad that you're part of our family of Shiros in education. And I'm really honored to have you on our podcast today because working with the underrepresented student is something that I focused on my entire career. So I'm excited to hear all about the work that you've done in this space and all the other spaces that you've been in. Now, as we kind of go through our conversation, we explore models of leadership and we focus on something we refer to as a pattern of M, role models, mentors, mirrors, movements, and mavericks. So from those who inspired you personally to ladies inspiring each of us around the globe.
And Keisha, don't forget, we want to explain any edubabble we might use. And so I mentioned these TED Talks that I think everybody should go listen to. And one of them is called Class Matters, Beyond the Access to Inclusion. And Sue also wrote a monograph for NASPA that's connected and related to that. Sue, welcome to the show. Can you help us understand what these TED Talks and NASPA are about?
Sure. First, I just want to say thank you. I'm honored to be here. And what critical work to connect a bunch of us who value the same thing and are committed to women and leadership and the world being a better place. So it's really an honor to be here. So NASPA is the National Association of Student Affairs Professionals. And student affairs is the field of the out of classroom, right? The deans of students, vice presidents of student affairs, all of those things on a campus that are outside the classroom. I like to think a little bit about Helen Keller and her remarkable teacher and how everything Ann Sullivan used was in the environment, right? So sometimes it was shoelaces and sunshine and water. I think student affairs at its best is taking what is ever in the environment and connecting students with new ideas and new people and all of those kinds of things. So it's a really fun place to be.
And you know, Sue, the thing that people don't notice unless they're in higher education, I think, is that it's also one of the major recruitment tools a university has is
Absolutely.
All the things that the students can be engaged in, involved in, and just the overall ecosystem that students live in
right.
when they're outside of the classroom, which is
right.
really a majority of their time. So
right.
I'm so excited to have you here and have you part of our conversation today. So are you ready to get started with your role models?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
So let's get started and share with us who your role models are and why.
You know, there's so many, so I tried to limit it. I wonder if all the people you're interviewing have the same thing. There's so many of them. The first would have to be my grandma. My grandma was a tough Detroit bar broad, and I was the oldest of 19 grandchildren. That's her term, not mine. I was the oldest of 19 grandchildren, so I always said I was her favorite. And she was just, you know, when I say grandma, it always doesn't really get who she is. I mean, she had red hair and wore big boas late into her 60s. And I would meet all of her friends at the bar. But she told me a couple really critical things in my life that made me roll my eyes as a kid. One was she used to say, I cried because I had no shoes until I saw a man who had no feet. I'm like, okay, really? And as I got older, what I realized was that's something that stayed with me through college, through everything. And she also used to say to me that I was more fortunate, but I wasn't better than anyone, and that everyone deserved our respect. And when I graduated from college, she called me and apologize for not being able to give me anything. She didn't have money. She didn't have. And I said, are you kidding me? The two things I carry with me and who I am is what you gave me, right? So she's really key. And then I've lived into my daughter as one of my role models. I think I always say she's what happens when you raise a healthy kid. She has amazing boundaries. She has a remarkable heart. She deals with no BS, mine included. She's clean emotionally. She's compassionate and watching her parent. I keep saying I should write an essay called In One Generation because I was an emancipated minor from a really abusive home. So I'm now watching this kid, my kid, parent in a way that takes my breath away. So those are two. And then I would just tell you, but I don't need to talk about him, but lately in my life, it has been Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Sonia Sotomayor, and Wilma Rudolph. Wilma Rudolph's been with me a long time.
Well, that is a group that I think needs a dinner party with you being the hostess.
There you go.
I love the concept of that essay. I can't wait to read it. I think that's your next publication.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Barack Obama, and Keisha and I are big fans. I know Keisha even had a chance to have him visit her school district when she was leading work there. And he says that change will not come if we wait for some other person or
right.
some other time.
Right.
We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek. So you definitely live that in your mission. And I'm curious, who might be some of the mentors that have guided you to do such work?
Oh, wow. I think when you go back through the course of history, it's the people that did, right? It's, you know, you ask a question about mirrors that we'll come back to. But I think about, in terms of mentors, you know, I have a college professor that pulled me under her wing as a first-generation college student. She was just amazing. Her name was Helen Grace Wilson, and my son is named Bryce Wilson after her. And she, third week of school, called me into her office, and I was totally freaked as a first-generation college student. She said to me, you know, you're going to need to stick with me to get through here. And I was like, why? And she said, well, she said, I was at a Nazarene college. The Nazarenes have a pretty narrow definition of what's okay, and you don't. And she said, and that's really okay, but you're far too ecumenical. And I was like, what is that and why is it bad? And she said, well, you just think there are too many ways. So she really pulled me in. She made me her TA for Japanese literature. I was supposed to be in a Minority Voices literature course, and I was her TA for 3 years. And then I was her, you know, Friday help assistant for the next decade, long after I graduated. Dr. Daryl Smith from CGU was really critical to my work, my initial work in diversity and class. And I'm not sure I'd have finished the dissertation work. I always said I'd have been a better apprentice than somebody who's a book learner because my funnel goes up, not down. And then Russ Rogers was in my graduate program, and he was really, really powerful. And I think my thing with mentors is, it's like, for me, it's been a village. You know, the same way I was raised, it was a village of mentors. And I think mentors can also be a good piece of music or a good idea. Sometimes we put pressure on people to find a mentor. It's not the same thing as going to the grocery store and picking out, you know, which box of oatmeal you're going to get. So I think finding people who do what you love, reading about people who do the work you aspire to, and then sometimes having the courage to reach out to them and say, can I take you to coffee? I mean, I think that's another way to get at the mentors.
You know, when you were sharing the story about your experience at the Nazarene University, it really resonated. I also graduated from a Nazarene University.
Which one?
Trevecca.
Oh, okay.
I was like, oh my gosh, I wish we had been at the same campus. It would have been so much easier.
I don't know. I don't know if either one of us would have finished.
It's true. But I'm happy that you found a wonderful mentor there. And it sounds like so much of what she taught you, you've really kind of incorporated into almost every aspect of your life, probably. I think that's what's so cool about our early mentors is, you know, sometimes at the time you don't even realize that they're a mentor. And then you look back and you're like, oh my gosh. And that's, you know, that's kind of what this next question is, a look back in the mirror. And when did you look in the mirror and see a leader looking back at you?
I'm not sure I ever did. You know, when you read the Barack Obama quote, for me, as I'm, you know, one, first generation emancipated minor, so I don't have the experience of being inside. I felt like an outsider always. And then you go to a denomination that you've never been a part of. They have their own language. Higher ed has its own language. And you're the person kind of running all the time trying to catch up. Yes, and starting in seventh grade, I was the president of my class. And I have been involved in leadership all the way. And yet at every level, it was like, okay, so who's going to take care of that? And I looked over my shoulder and was like, oh, that's me. I don't think I ever looked in the mirror and went, you're the director, you're the vice president, you're the this. I kind of looked around at what needed to be done. And much like Barack Obama says, you know, be that leader, right? And I think we spend and waste way too much time trying to fit into some leadership mode, right? And every single day, we have the opportunity to provide leadership. Whether it's how we treat people in the grocery line, I invited a young woman to my course to speak yesterday. She didn't go to college. She calls herself uneducated. She was homeless for a decade. And she's running a project called the Porch Project, in which in Flint, the idea was, you clean up the porches, you get to know your neighbors, lots of good things happen. She started with no money. She was going to do 17 porches. Makes me choky to say this. She's done 1,000 porches. She's in 3 countries and 17 states. She's 27 years old. And what I think about her is she stood in front of my class and said, what she got challenged about was being the young person at the table and the uneducated one. And I had to stop the class and say, you are not uneducated. You do not have a college degree. That's different than being uneducated. And this is exactly why I invited you to my class. We don't have to wait till tomorrow or wait for Godot or wait for a particular reason to be a leader in our sphere of influence. Every day we can lead. And sometimes that's leading in kindness. Sometimes that's leading in grace. It's not building a house or building a department or hitting the enrollment targets. So I think for me, I don't know that I still, you know, when I see myself in my regalia on my website periodically, I'm like, oh, wait, who is that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's me. But I still think I live in that place of find out what needs to be done and who wants to do it with you and get it done.
Yeah, you are definitely a model, a role model, and a fierce female role model. You know, when you talk about your regalia and we think about the chancellor, you have such a humanness around what you do and how you do your work. Even in this example of this porch project and who you bring into the classroom to funnel up models of leadership. Oh. And as you think about your role as a female and, you know, you mentioned Hillary and Wilma and Sonia, and I'm sure the list continues. How do you see women changing the world, yourself included, of course?
I think in big ways and small ways. I think one of the things about women, and I don't know all the biology pieces or, you know, I don't want to get into gender stereotypes, but I think we pay attention to detail that's about humans, right? So we sometimes, the downside is we almost can't keep it out, right? We almost don't have a way of keeping all that detail out. So I think in a lot of small ways, day-to-day ways, you know, my daughter's not working outside the house right now, but she's raising 6 children that go into the universe with a kind of energy that everywhere they go, you just watch them and watch people react to them. One of the teachers said in parent conferences about the 10-year-old, and he's the one most likely to be throat chopped on any given day. And every day, every year that teacher conference she goes to, they talk about Callan's, he doesn't let anybody sit alone. If there's a new kid sitting alone or a sad kid sitting alone, Callan will go over and sit with them or ask him to sit with him. If somebody gets hurt on the playground, he's the one nurturing. He's the oldest of the 5 boys. But to see that happen outside the home and he doesn't even bat an eye, I think that makes the world different. Her other boy child, who's 7 now, is excited that there's a vice president who looks like him. And he tells anybody who will listen that there's a vice president who looks like him. I think that says to the world, those role models matter. People think snowflakes are making up that students like seeing people like them in school. I got a 7-year-old that tells me at every moment. And then I think in the big ways, man, I heard Sonia Sotomayor say when people asked her how she could be such good friends with Scalia and they were at opposite ends, she said, you know, we both love the law, we both love the country, and we don't doubt each other's intentions. Gosh, every day of my life, I try to say, how do I walk in the world not doubting someone's intentions? And I think the more you move in leadership, the harder it can be to not doubt the intentions of others. Because you've got a job to do and an agenda, they've got a job to do and an agenda, and sometimes they're going in opposite directions. But to not personalize, to not make that about the two of you, I think that's a huge way to change the world. Then you look at the women who founded Black Lives Matter. I mean, those were 3 women almost out of that born an experience. I mean, born a movement out of their experience. Greta Thunberg. I mean, the list goes on and on. Malala, of all these young women who are finding voices and helping other people find voice. And I think ultimately that's going to change the world. sometimes not fast enough for me when I go to bed at night, but I think those are some of the ways. And if we can continue to build that net of support for the world with all those different kinds of things women are doing, you can't stop that power.
No, you're so right. And you have listed countless women who have done incredible work and incredible influence, and from a place of great humility. You know, I don't think any of the people you listed, you know, kind of came into their teens saying, I'm going to do this. It's just at their core, and it's just something that they became. And then thank goodness somebody saw it and it resonated and it lifted up, and now we can all get to benefit from it. Speaking of benefiting from things, one of the things that my friendship with Frances has done is it's put a bright spotlight on how little I care about myself. I'm terrible at it, Sue.
Well, I understand
and
that.
Frances is amazing at it. And every day she texts me some super inspiring, you know, be kind to yourself comment, even this morning. And, but I'm really good at beating myself up. So how do you take care of yourself? You've got so many balls that you're juggling. You are such an influential being on this planet. So how does Sue take care of Sue?
It's a lesson, long time learning. You know, I went to the doctor a year and a half ago and they started talking about all these things. I'm like, I didn't have any of that before I came in. Cause I didn't go to the doctor. Right. So you didn't have anything if you didn't go to the doctor. I've always heard about people talking about you can have it all. And I think the first thing is, what does all mean? Right. Cause all is some undefined thing and we set people up to find. I had a really hard time when my daughter decided she was going to have babies and not go back to work or do her master's degree. Oh my gosh. I thought I was going to fall off the planet, because for me, coming from a family that didn't want us, they didn't want me, to getting my education and thinking it opened the world, she was going to do this thing. And again, I got to tell you, that child has said to me since she was 12, she came home once and said, you need to lay down on the floor. I'm going to teach you how to breathe. I was like, what? And she said, she came from some class and they had a wellness class, I think. And she said, you're only breathing from the top quarter of your lungs. You need to lay down on the floor and let me teach you to breathe. And I could only think of, oh, you know, I'm one of the namaste, I don't do yoga, because I have a Saturday Night Live sense of humor. And I can't. I can box. You know, my partner says, oh, man, you need to meditate. Oh, when I start meditating, I hear Saturday Night Live. Now, saying all that, I sit at the end of my dock and I watch the sunset. And sometimes I film it for 30 seconds because most of the people in my life don't believe that I can sit still for 30 seconds. Sitting at the end of that dock, watching the sunset, watching the moon come up. And I think there's always been a part of me, because I love the outdoors, that played outdoors, right? The age of my daughter and group, I never said, oh man, I'm tired or I feel like this. And you know, some of that I think is class, some of that's being a survivor, but watching the young women in my life. I mean, think about Naomi Osaka. When I got to California and people said, oh yeah, and my therapist said this, and would you pass a ketchup? I was like, they just said therapist out loud. I mean, you just didn't do that in a poor neighborhood in the Midwest, right? We didn't even know therapists that we knew of. But here's Naomi Osaka on one of the largest stations, stages in the world, saying, look, I can't do this. And you know what? Tons of people tried to shame that child, right? And she just stood in her truth. That to me is an inspiration. That to me, I've had to learn to not say when I sit down, and I don't do this very often because I sit with a book or if I'm watching ball games, I'm online, that it's not being lazy to not do something. And I think that's a challenge for women. One, we discount a lot of the work we do, you know, the in-between work, right? And we think if we're not moving, there's an issue. Not that we're repairing or restoring, and everything we know in our minds about space is that it takes that kind of space to be creative and productive and grounded and all of those things. So I think it's a struggle for me, but my commitment to playing hard helps me. And I never wanted to miss a minute. I mean, the gift of being somewhat of an orphan and an emancipated minor when I had my own children, I never wanted to miss a minute. So if I had to work until 2 o'clock in the morning on my dissertation so that I could go to their softball game, I did it. And I have only one single regret, and it's that I didn't go into the Navy. But beyond that, I have very few regrets.
Well, standing in your truth sounds like you're all.
Yeah.
And you have found different ways of, I'm with you. I think boxing is like meditating too. It's the only way you can focus and clear out that SNL list.
That's right. You know, I had a guy, I did kickboxing, and at the very end, he would hold the bag and you would hit that. And when I got there, he would say to me, you know, you scare me. And I said, why? And he goes, because you like this. I go, of course I like it. But yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. So
fun and consciousness. And you mentioned space. So I'm going to give you and Keisha a little thing that happens in my hot yoga class on Wednesday nights.
See what I'm
and
saying?
And that
Sue?
Is, they also what's that?
I said, see what I'm saying, Sue?
Namaste.
How about yoga?
How about us?
2 or 3 times a week, let me tell you.
And I think it's so powerful for us as women, as we think about self-care being radical, is that so often we think about, like, don't take up space, don't take up space. And at the end they say, take up all the space you can.
Wow.
Because you are meant to be in this space. So I encourage you, if it's SNL space, boxing space, at the end of the doc space, take up your space because we need more of you.
Well, thank you.
And Keisha, I think there's some ways we can learn even more about Sue. Do you have a little game ready for us?
I do.
Uh-oh.
Oh, I love this
I
part.
Do. This is a fun part. It's kind of how we end our show, and it's with some sentence starters. So here is a sentence starter, and you can just finish it however you choose. I became a stronger person after
I realized I wasn't afraid of what I didn't know. I could always find a way now. I had the skills to find it, but I realized I was no longer afraid of what I didn't know.
How about this one? An event that changed my worldview.
Traveling in Africa with my son when he finished travel abroad. We spent 2 weeks traveling with one of his teachers and in a Jeep, figuring out where we were going to stay every night. And he spoke enough Swahili to get us by. And I learned so much. You know, we all talk as educators about engaged learning. This was a boy who had trouble in school after first grade. And he would ride around and his teacher would say, Vicelli, tell mama, what is that print? What is that print? So watching him and traveling with him, it changed my life.
Oh my gosh. So cool. A, that being with your kid changed your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I believe in that so much. Yeah. Family is like everything. It's how I do self-care. And Africa is one of the most beautiful continents on the planet. And I'm going to introduce you to Margot Gooday. When we finally get to meet up in person.
Okay.
She is the yin to your yang, my friend. When you meet her, okay, it's going to be like y'all have known each other for decades. I can't wait. And she's in our little Shiro club too. I can't wait for you two to meet one of us. She does a tremendous amount of work, by the way, in Africa.
Oh, wow.
And you've got it. Don't you think, Frances? She and Margot be like,
absolutely. I love listening to her podcast.
Well, and Bryce would write me letters. You know, he never wrote, right? He would write me these letters. And really, I went to bear witness because, he was convinced that all these things he didn't know. And I wanted to say back to him, these were so many caverns in his heart that just kind of got opened. It's like, it so resonated with who he was. And I wanted to both be able to say, yes, it's life-changing. And buddy, this is who you have been, and welcome home, right? So it was great. It was remarkable for me.
That's so cool. All right, here's another one. My life improved when I...
When I came out. You know, you live with a lot of fear, fear of losing my kids, fear of people finding out. I was working as a dean of student, as a associate dean of students at a Christian college, and was being named the dean, and allowed them to name me 24 hours, and then I stepped away because even before I knew the word congruence, that was really important to me, and I couldn't be there believing what I believed, even if I kept it quiet, and I just don't feel like that's worth it at all. And it took me about 7 years. I was afraid I would lose the kids. It was, you know, the 80s, late 80s. And I was afraid I would lose them. I was afraid I would lose everything I have. And having left with nothing as an emancipated minor, you kind of build this world back. And I thought I would lose it all. And at 3 o'clock one morning, I thought, if I wanted my kids to know one thing in the world, what would it be? And it was that I loved them no matter what, and they could always come home. And I thought, how can they believe that? How would they believe that if they knew I was not living in congruence? And then I decided to come out. And they were like in first and second grade. And at the time, it really meant not much to them. But... it's been pretty crazy as we've grown up. Their dad came out a year later, so that's a whole nother podcast. Yeah, my daughter always says, what was in the water where you guys dated? But that really changed a lot for me.
Thank you for sharing that. It almost is full circle to that comment you mentioned earlier. The caverns of your heart are full. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, again, going back to that concept of how you grow things exponentially, mm-hmm. you grew love and mm-hmm. truth and standing in that relationship as a result. You know, it might sound silly for me to ask this next question after such a powerful response, but let's go for it. This next one is a decision that changed your life.
You know, no, it's not silly. My decision to keep walking after my mother threw me out changed my life. I was 15. I thought it was going to be for the weekend, and then the week, and then 2 weeks, and then I thought, I'll be home by spring break. And that was my junior year in high school, and I went home twice to try to, as you know, what was I, 15 and 16, do whatever I thought I should do, but I never went home again. And I was aware, probably by my 30s, if I'd have agreed to go home to the abuse and whatnot, I probably could have gone home again. But whatever flip switched in me then was, I'm not doing this. And as I got older, I just didn't, you know, my brother would tell you that when he was in second grade and I was in third, I said I was not going to live like we were living when I grew up. I wasn't going to hit people or hurt people, or I just wasn't going to. And for some reason, I always knew that, and acting on it. I mean, I remember walking down the street and both feeling elated and terrified. One, I was aware that all that was left for them to do was to kill me, and that wasn't a bad option. And two, I was, and that was relief, frankly, and I was terrified because I knew there would never be anyone in for me from a parental standpoint at a wedding or a birth or any of that. I was raised by a village that stepped into that, but that radically changed my life.
That knowing and acting, that tension, yeah. And how you manage that so beautifully and carry that lesson forward, yeah. For the students that you serve, the families that you serve, and the community that you have embraced in so many different ways and in facets is part of the reason you're our hero, mm-hmm. right? You stand in your truth. and you lead with such conviction and relationship that it speaks to our soul in so many different ways. And such a soulful response always comes from my partner here, Keisha Ray. So, you know, Keisha, I have to do that teaching question I've always asked you.
It's true.
I've shared a little bit about what I've learned, and I know that you've been taking copious notes, and I see your brain just like on fire with ideas. What are you learning from this amazing chancellor?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I myself have lived homeless, but I was in college. And I can't imagine, I mean, I was scared for my life. I can't imagine being 15 years old and in that situation. I can't fathom it. I mean, you don't know where to go to the bathroom. I mean, there's like fundamental things. You don't know where to shower. You don't know where to eat. There's just fundamental things when you have no home.
Doctors.
You just go into this, I don't know, survival mode. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what you did. Mm-hmm. And it's just so inspiring. And at such a young age. And I think, I mean, your TED Talks are so inspiring and such incredible work supporting our least represented students. I mean, that you are a champion of, among champions for that population of student. And I bet many of them don't know your story.
Right.
Some may, but many of them don't.
Right.
So they're probably like, why is this like privileged lady all concerned about me?
Mm-hmm.
And they have no idea. So hopefully they'll listen to this podcast and they'll hear a little bit about the true Sue. I love what you said about your daughter. And, you know, it speaks to the kind of mother that you are and how incredibly influential you have been over her life, having no role model as a mother in yours.
Mm-hmm.
And that, Sue, is priceless to her, to you, to me as a new mom. I think your comments around not doubting others' intentions really resonated with me. I've never really considered that before. And I wrote that down and it's going to be a post-it note on my computer because I think I do that more than I should. And I appreciate you just calling that out and helping raise awareness to that unintentional act that we probably do every day. And I love how true you are to yourself and to your loves, to your children, to your wife, and to your life.
Mm-hmm.
Your story is very, very inspirational. And I just appreciate from the bottom of my heart you sharing it with us today.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Is there anything that you haven't shared that you want to leave our audience with?
I think years of trying to teach and what's the key point and what's this and what's that. And I'm at the place in my life now where I think at the end of my life, I hope what they can say is that I loved well and I was well loved. And if that can be said, that means the other stuff I did either worked or mattered or, you know, passed muster. But I think that's it. I think sometimes, you know, we keep thinking of what's the secret of life and what am I going to be? What am I going to do? You know this for being homeless. There's lots of questions that hang out there. And I'm really comfortable now with, you know, at the end, if they can say I loved well, was well loved, that's all good.
Well, we absolutely love you. And I know our listeners are in love with you as well. We're going to encourage them to keep listening to this talk because I'm sure each time there's going to be another seed of wisdom that will continue to grow, and to encourage them to visit those TED Talks and follow you and the great work that you're doing. You know, thanks again, Keisha and Sue. This has just been an incredible, powerful journey. And, you know, we always want to leave our listeners with something to continue thinking about. And so today's coaching question is the following. In your honor, Sue, we ask our listeners, how might you embrace the power of your truth and lead in a relational way? How might you embrace the power of your truth and lead in a relational way?
Oh, that's a good coaching question. And we hope our audience will respond to that question on our hashtag TL Honor Roll, ROLE, so that we can see all of your comments and responses to that incredible question. And Sue, we can't thank you enough for spending a little bit of time with us today and sharing your personal and relational experiences. And I just want to encourage our audience to join us for our next podcast, where we're going to highlight another Shero in education and explore their M's. And again, don't forget to respond to Francis's coaching question with our hashtag TLHonorRoll. And until then,
be fierce
and be formidable.
The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is produced by Keisha Ray, Francis Gibson, and Christine Weiser. Audio production by Mitchell Tulin and AV Nation. Tech and Learning's Honor Roll theme music is by Madison Van Gundy. Find more episodes on techlearning.com and follow us at hashtag TL Honor Roll. That's TL Honor R-O-L-E.